Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary. Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
And welcome again to the Explaining History podcast. This is the first podcast of 2024. Some kind of 12 years since I started doing this, and it's going to be a slightly different one today. I've not done a podcast for about a month or so. Generally, kind of health and stuff, and a bunch of other things have kind of intervened. But you know, don't worry about me. I want to kind of address something really, an error of mine, I would say, an error of judgment on the current situation in Gaza. I've always kind of maintained a policy on the podcast, not that I would shy away from things that are happening right now. Of course, you know, in the past, looking at Ukraine and the various kind of criminal antics of British prime ministers, I've held forth on a number of topics. I didn't talk about Gaza, and I didn't talk about Gaza for a particular reason. And it was a kind of sense of stepping back, because I believed that there were better commentators out there to talk about what was happening. And that was an error. Of course, there are much better commentators out there to talk about what's happening, but I believe that a certain point comes when you have a podcast like this, that's listened to around the world, you know, not wanting to kind of brag or anything, but it is listened to internationally, and I've talked about the Arab-Israeli conflicts throughout the 20th century many, many times. I've talked about the history of Jewish people in various different contexts, from the Holocaust to various Jewish diasporas. I've talked about human rights. I've talked about Western imperialism. I've talked about the meddling of various great powers, from the British to the Americans to the Soviets in the Middle East. You know, I've talked about all of these things over the past 12 years. And so I can't not address what is happening at the moment. And it's, you know, this is late in the day for me, and I apologise for that. But it's also a situation that is constantly changing, and is perhaps... perhaps going to produce some kind of, shall we say, unexpected results. Firstly, for the avoidance of doubt, let's get a few things out of the way. You know, this will polarise many of the people that listen to this podcast in a number of different ways. Of course, it goes without saying that the attack on October the 7th by Hamas on Israeli citizens and obviously on the Israeli Defense Force was a dreadful crime. And it was one where I believe it was intended to produce, much as 9/11 was intended to produce the response that Bin Laden had wanted, and you know, it's what he got. This was intended to do exactly the same thing. Hamas is obviously an Iranian-backed militia that has been the ruling power in Gaza, not in the West Bank, but in Gaza, for the last 16 years at least. And the Iranians had an interest in destabilizing Israel. The fear on the part of Iran was that America, America's long-term diplomatic kind of maneuvering in the Middle East to bring a kind of an accord between Saudi Arabia and Israel, the two and the rest of the Gulf states, the main American client states in the Middle East, would create a power block that would place Iran once again in a very difficult position in terms of sanctions and that sort of thing. So this is a play by Iran. It's important to recognise that neither Iran nor Hamas care one jot about the fate of the Palestinian people. Even the simplest analysis would have concluded the day before October 7th that mass casualties, as Israel would respond with extraordinary brutality. One only has to look back at the track record of Israel towards Palestinian Arabs and other Arabic peoples since 1948 to know that they would have no qualms about mass civilian casualties, and that has been shown. So that's one point. It is also hardly a conspiracy theory. This has been reported in Haaretz, the kind of the Israel's liberal newspaper, and the various kind of centre-right newspapers, that Benjamin Netanyahu had a long-term policy of actually encouraging Hamas. Why? Because the real party that offered the possibility of a viable Palestinian state was Fatah, formerly led by Yasser Arafat, who were throughout most of the post-war period a largely secular national liberation organization, the likes of, you know, akin to various national liberation movements around the world. And these weren't Islamic fundamentalists. They were people who wanted to create a viable Palestinian state. This is something that even the supposedly moderate parties in Israel, if you look at parties like Likud, for example, the Israeli equivalent of the British Labour Party, even moderate parties in Israel have been committed to preventing. So it was partly Netanyahu's policy to allow flows of money from donors in the Gulf states to Hamas, because firstly it creates a kind of scary demonic sort of enemy, the kinds of people that wear black balaclavas and wave AK-47s around, and also it gave justification for the idea that Israel cannot make peace with these sorts of individuals because they simply want to destroy the state of Israel and wipe all remnants of it from the Middle East. And so it results in this kind of incubating this kind of monstrous organization in Gaza. The reality is that a monstrous organization does exist, largely without the kind of the widespread popular appeal within Gaza, Countless reports of Gaza and Palestinians living under a sort of like a police state-like regime under Hamas. The reality, of course, is that Fatah itself is hugely corrupt and seen as being, under Mahmoud Abbas, seen as being incapable of doing anything at all for the Palestinians. And so you have people within Gaza who've been under siege for 16 years, whose access literally to calories is restricted through checkpoints, who unsurprisingly, having nowhere else to turn, do support people who have violent aims towards the people on the other side of the fence, who are pointing guns from sentry points at them. The thing about the October the 7th attack is that it all evidence and looks like it was planned for at least a year. No doubt there were Israeli intelligence failings. That is entirely possible. I don't believe that the more conspiratorial ideas that this is something that Israeli politicians allowed to happen. I don't believe that. I think if you had one individual within the regime that said, "Oh, you know, let's let this atrocity happen, and that will give us a casus belli to annihilate the Palestinians," there are countless sort of administrators and intelligence officers and military planners all the way down, and at least one of them would no doubt have said, "Well, come on, this is crazy. You can't just allow, you know, 1,000+ civilians to die like this." And so, yeah, I don't find that convincing. What I do imagine is that a lot of the faith that Israel placed in its border wall, its tech solutions, are kind of, there are echoes of countless other examples of people placing faith in these sort of tech solutions to deal with the very human anger and resentment and hatred and bitterness and rage that is the product of decades upon decades of occupation and colonial oppression. In many ways, if you look at what's happening to the Palestinians and what is happening to the Israelis, the beneficiary of all of this temporarily is the United States. The United States has its client state in the Middle East. The United States gives it Israel, and has always given Israel via diplomacy through the UN, you know, vetoing United Nations Security Council resolutions, giving huge subsidized arms sales to Israel, and you're shipping weapons to Israel in its time of need, for example, in 1973. America creates the situation where Israel is able to act with impunity, which might be something that would be attractive to someone like Benjamin Netanyahu, but it's really a really huge disservice to Israeli citizens. To allow and encourage and create greater levels of kind of radicalization at the top. And of course, the radicalization within the Israeli government is partly the product of Netanyahu having to, or choosing to, bring into his coalition the representatives of the settlers in the West Bank, people who are absolutely convinced of their right, which is a flagrant breach of international law, which has been established all the way since 1967, that they have a right to settle on the lands that are currently occupied by Palestinians. If one looks at the map of the West Bank and what has changed since 1967, there is kind of almost no meaningful kind of stretch of Palestinian occupied land there anymore. It's just simply this kind of pockmarked kind of morass of settlements and roads. What this does, what that does, is it results in there being no viable two-state solution. The largest section of formerly Palestinian lands is the West Bank. If you settle on there, and moving the heavily armed settlers out is, one would have to employ the Israeli Defense Force in order to do that, is a recipe almost for civil war. There's no way that is achievable without tearing Israel apart. When you have Western politicians in the White House and in 10 Downing Street and a leader of the opposition, Sir Keir Starmer, saying that they believe in a two-state solution, they know, well, either they are so wildly unqualified to comment as they should, you know, recuse themselves from the conversation for all time, or they know they're saying something that's completely impossible. You know, I believe in this fantastical situation where, oil and water are kind of magically separated, and that's the thing we're holding out for. Well, this is a nonsense, and it gives cover to Israel to perpetrate its crimes. And by crimes, by recent estimates, we're looking at something like in the order of 30,000 deaths, of whom a little over 10,000, perhaps 12, the numbers are kind of are shifting because people are being murdered every day, perhaps 12 or 13,000 are children. And there are something like about 7,000 bodies under the rubble of Gaza that will probably never be identified. Gazans are beginning to starve. There is no food there. There's no clean drinking water. The conditions for communicable diseases to rip through the population are rife. And no serious military thinker believes that this will bring Israel any peace at all. Israel has, in fact, suffered one or two quite alarming defeats. A recent triple ambush by Hamas of Israeli soldiers, killing some quite senior officers, indicates that Hamas are still ready to fight. Every successive repression of the Palestinian people since 1948 has led to fresh waves of young men, mainly, not exclusively men, but mainly young men, picking up weapons and joining the fight for the next uprising, the next attack. So none of this will in any meaningful way bring Israel any security, but it's going to harm Israel in another way as well. Israel has been able in the post-war era to present itself as the only democracy in the Middle East. It has been able to present itself as the state that was born from the Holocaust. There are elements of truth to both of these claims. It's been able to present itself as a Western ally, and it's been able to present itself as particularly as an ally to NATO, not a member of NATO, but an ally to the kind of NATO powers during the Cold War. It's been benefited from some excellent public relations. It has been able to diplomatically and in soft power terms punch above its weight successfully for decades. And this, I confidently predict, for much of the world is over. The reason why is we are looking at a genocide. The claim of genocide is currently being debated at the International Court of Justice in The Hague. If you really want to get an amazing contemporaneous write-up on what is happening in the court, Craig Murray, former British ambassador to Uzbekistan, and friend of Julian Assange and kind of campaigner for radical causes, various, is currently writing on a daily basis from in the court. He's an excellent kind of reporter, and some really, really kind of interesting home truths are being presented there. Of course, the South African government has long kind of post-apartheid emotional ties to the issue of Palestine. Nelson Mandela, Palestine was very, very close to his heart, and he said essentially that nobody was free until Palestine was free. I paraphrase, anyway. South Africa are leading a huge part of non-Western world opinion. People who live in Western countries, myself included, very often fail to acknowledge that the worldview that we, the normative worldview that we share about things, is very often not shared in large parts of Africa, Asia, South America, places that have experienced European colonialism up close. The charge of genocide is being put before the court. There is abundant evidence all the way from Netanyahu invoking Amalek, a moment in Judean, so Hebrew history, where the attackers of Judea are wiped off the face of the earth, and their civilians massacred and their fields planted with salt and all that kind of stuff. From that sort of thing to the daily live televisation of the massacre of civilians.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Most of the genocide heirs of the 20th century and the mass killers of the 20th century, and I make that distinction because there are certain things, such as, for example, Mao's famines, which killed probably more than nearly most of the genocides of the 20th century put together, that are legalistically not considered to be genocides, but they are appalling mass atrocities beyond our ability to imagine. Most of those individuals, from Cambodia's killing fields through to the Srebrenica massacre, try to keep it quiet. They don't do these things in the glare of world opinion. The what we see in Gaza at the moment is really quite exceptional. It really stands out as something quite different. It is a genocide in real time. And if you look at the legalistic definitions of genocide, the mass killing, the intent to level civilian populations, the intent to remove civilians from the land on which they inhabited, There is always rhetoric about, you know, taking the entirety of the Palestinian population and dumping them in tent cities in the middle of the Sinai Desert. This is the language of genocide. It's popularly assumed that a genocide truly is the annihilation, the complete and utter annihilation of an entire people. And it's not quite, the definition of genocide is not quite as simple as that. There are all sorts of ways in which genocides can be perpetrated, from the erasure of a culture all the way through to mass killing. Of course, if one thinks of the genocide that was the Holocaust, had the Holocaust continued, yes, probably all of Europe's Jews would have been murdered. However, those that survived, we don't simply discount the Holocaust and say it wasn't a genocide because, oh, look, there were some who escaped or got away or survived the camps. A rather obvious point, but something sometimes worth making. So a genocide is happening in real time, and the British and the American governments and the German government still kind of trying in its own way to deal with its own Holocaust guilt by greenlighting somebody else's genocide, and a variety of other European governments are giving it a free pass, if not, in the case of America, actively assisting. There are some interesting open source intelligence blogs out there that show the flights of Signals intelligence aircraft from Cyprus, from British bases in Cyprus, to across the Mediterranean to the coast of Gaza and back again. What they're doing, I don't know, but one can take a wild guess at how they are currently assisting the Israeli Defense Force. The Israeli Defense Force also has its own kind of media outriders in and sort of celebrity influencers around the world. Right at the very beginning of the mass killing of Palestinians, in the weeks after October the 7th, there's a very kind of ill-advised letter of support from dozens of Hollywood celebrities who've now gone suspiciously quiet on the subject, was circulated. So there is this kind of soft power which is currently being squandered, and it is also a Western soft power. Western rhetoric on human rights, long thought to be a sort of a joke, is being revealed as being such. Human rights are something to berate Chinese premiers with on the issue of Tibet or the Uyghur people. They are something to be ignored when hosting the Israeli Prime Minister at 10 Downing Street, or at the White House, or the King of Saudi Arabia, or take your pick. These are things that were established for very good reason as the basis of international law after the Second World War, which are now used as political footballs. They're now used in the most kind of insincere and kind of fickle of ways. And I'm not suggesting here for a moment that there's anything wrong with the principle of human rights. It's one of the few things that have kind of emerged from the Second World War, which you gave one cause for sort of optimism in the world. But their application, the idea that there isn't universality, that for some peoples in some parts of the world, particularly Palestinians, that they don't apply, and the rights that Palestinian children have to life are, to be largely ignored. This is something that kind of brings Western governments and Western society, as if you can think of such a thing, to kind of new levels of kind of cynicism. Part of the way in which kind of the entire issue was sort of obscured and complicated, and a very sort of a regular kind of line, which I think was obviously being circulated en masse by somebody somewhere, was to tell, and this was said in sort of in news studios up and down the land, that the whole issue is very, very complicated. Sure. Well, there is a contradiction here. We were encouraged to see the massacres of October the 7th, hideous as they were, out with any kind of historical context. Okay? So you can... the massacres just appeared out of the blue, and there wasn't 75 years of context there. Okay, unless there certainly is 75 years of context there. Not to justify them, but there is always context. This is the whole point of this podcast. I should have the tagline: there is always context. And now, a secondary argument of those supporting the massacres in Gaza is, it's complicated. Okay, there is a long, complicated history that we sort of can't understand. The first point, encourages to think of there being no history whatsoever, that these, these Hamas militiamen popped out of a hole in the ground. The second point says, well, there is a kind of story, but it's too complicated for anyone to understand. And can we just kind of look at things in terms of good and bad, civilization and barbarity? The idea that is propagated sometimes is that were it not for Israel, Israel is sort of like, holding back the horde, if you will. And that barbarity kind of begins at sort of Israel's borders, and Israel is some sort of kind of gatekeeper. Well, that argument is obviously a nonsense, and we can see barbarity right now as we look at the images of children's bodies in morgues, and we hear of stories of incubators being switched off, that kind of thing. There was a thing that was written by Mike Davis. I didn't really understand this at the time. Mike Davis, if you are interested in his works, he died the other year. He's a brilliant, brilliant guy. He was a kind of radical urban geographer and socialist. And he said, well, in the 21st century, at some point, we'll be fighting the oppressors hand to hand, as if we were in the rubbles of Stalingrad. And I didn't quite understand what he meant. But in a 21st century where there is, unfortunately, like to be less of everything, as the climate crisis takes its toll, where internationalism has crumbled and borders are being erected around the world with big keep out signs on them, where the 1% who rulers siphon off vast amounts of wealth upwards, where transformative technologies leave high streets barren and communities collapsing, and where client states of the world's most powerful entities and the world's most powerful empires are able to act with impunity. Perhaps the rubble that Mike Davis was talking about, or the first ruins that Mike Davis is talking about, are the ruins of Gaza. And it doesn't augur well for what comes next. But, the fact that Hamas, a dangerous, reactionary, bloodthirsty and entirely monstrous organization, hasn't been defeated, that gives me no comfort It gives me no comfort that somehow the Palestinian people will emerge from all of this, and the forces of the righteous will win. Well, you know, we're talking about history here, not Star Wars, aren't we? The forces of the righteous are almost always on history's losing side. But the fact of the matter is that I don't think Israel will win. I don't think Israel can win. I think that the ability to produce more and more hate and anger will eventually bring so many new militants to the fight, and so many generations of fighters to oppose Israel, that and Israel's soft power will be gradually eroded, wiped away, perhaps never to return. Israel's international standing will perhaps never recover, and perhaps in some ways it doesn't deserve to. And Israel will, the Israeli population, who I suspect are not looking for a long war. They've had a terrible shock and long memories of persecution and of the Holocaust and of the way that Jewish people have historically been treated, have been triggered with this kind of attack on a place that has been seen by diaspora and non-diaspora Jews as the fortress, really, that protects Jewish people from their enemies around the world, and the threat of further persecution. The fact that that has been threatened and shown to be weaker than anyone thought has triggered many Jewish people within Israel, many Israeli Jews, to want to fight back but the reality of that fight now is genocide. And the ability for Israel to talk about its origins, its roots, the persecution of the Jews through things such as like the Yad Vashem Museum and Memorial have been forever compromised. You know, what Israeli statesmen can meaningfully talk about genocide now without understanding that most of the world sees it as a perpetrator of genocide and not a victim of it. Okay, so that was a bit of a rambling one, and I rarely do podcast episodes like this, but here we are, you know, when the circumstances necessitated, I have to say again where I'm at with all of this. And it's, you know, I give my sincerest apologies for not doing this earlier. I really do. We'll be back to normal service next week, and we've got some great interviews coming up in the near future, and we'll be returning to a little bit. We had such a glut of amazing people. If you haven't listened to some of the interviews that I did last year, really check them out. You know, I'm not speaking for my own benefits, but I was privileged with some amazing people. Have a listen. But we're going to be doing some more standard kinds of podcasts where we look at different ideas that different writers have come up with and that kind of thing in 2024. And maybe I'll do something else like this as well. Anyway, thanks so much for listening, and wherever you are, all the very best. And I'll catch you on the next Explaining History podcast. Bye-bye.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Hi, I'm Ando.
And I'm Fer.
And we host Niñas Bien Podcast.
We want to invite you to listen to our show.
Niñas Bien means good girls in Spanish. But you have to know that this is not a podcast for good girls.
Or for girls at all. It is a comedy podcast. So everyone is welcome to listen.
We talk about sex, relationships, technology.
We recommend movies and TV shows and discuss pop culture in general.
And there is Chisme Ajeno too.
A section we have just to gossip about everyone. So you'll find something you like here.
And you'll practice your Spanish.
The cleanest Spanish you'll find, we promise.
And if you already hablas español,
vamos a ser tus nuevas amigas. We'll be your friends for the non-Spanish speakers.
New episodes every Monday and Thursday.
Hosted by Acast and available to all audio platforms.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.